Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. We've aired a few programs with an awesome endocrinologist from Baruch College in New York City, Dr. Jill Brind, on abortion and what killing an unborn child does to the mother's physical body and, of course, also her psyche, her soul, and her spirit. Now, for today's program, we get to interview another endocrinologist, Dr. Quentin Van Meter, Vice President of the American College of Pediatricians, and we're going to talk about how today's gender confusion harms children. Dr. Van Meter, it's an honor to speak with you here on Real Science Radio.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. First, can you remind us, what is an endocrinologist?
Endocrinologist is a physician who specializes in hormones, the production and response of hormones by the human body. So endo comes from the root word within, and it is the hormones are secreted by glands into the bloodstream, and that they work through the bloodstream to reach target organs.
So a hormone then is a chemical signal within an organism from maybe one gland to another, one gland to an organ, a gland to the brain, that kind of communication system?
Yes, exactly.
And then there's maybe a related phenomenon of pheromone. I've understood that's a chemical signal between organisms. That's sort of in the same field, only beyond endocrinology then, between individual organisms within a species, perhaps.
And it has to do with sense of smell, particularly the olfactory senses where pheromones are sensed, if you will. Mm. So infants and mothers, for instance, are tightly bonded that way. And human beings, likewise, and animals will signal to each other by the scent.
Wow. And Dr. Jill Brind, I mentioned, he has stated on this show, I'm not sure how common this thought is, but that the chemical signals from the baby, the embryo in the fallopian tube and in the mother's womb, those chemical signals from the baby to the mother could be considered pheromones because they're going from one body, one organism, the baby, to the mother. What do you think of that? Does that sound reasonable?
It does sound reasonable, and particularly the baby is bathed in the mother's amniotic fluid, which has a particular taste and odor to it, and the mother secretes the same chemicals on the surface of her skin around the nipples of the breast in particular, so that at the instant of the baby is born into the world, the baby seeks out that particular odor from the mother and will actually climb to the mother's breast to feed, because that is sort of the sense of one of their favorite, most comforting memories or olfactory memories they have. So it's really kind of cool.
Well, that's an astounding design. I'm just thrilled you shared that with us. So I would like to ask you about an article you guys have, the American College of Pediatricians, on your website, Gender Ideology Harms Children. But first, perhaps I could share with you a quote from a very popular website on gender. The site, it's over in Britain, and it's gender.org.uk. And it says this. I Googled a search for gender in the development of an embryo, and out of thousands of potential sites, Google ranked this one as number two. And they write this: from the moment of fertilization, the embryo grows as the cells multiply. During the first few weeks, it is neither male nor female. So that caught my attention, because we have heard this argument from pro-choice circles that the fetus in the womb, and from homosexual activists, that the embryo is not a male and it's not a female until the seventh or eighth week.
Well, that's patently untrue. The genetic sex of the baby is determined by the the presence of the Y chromosome along with the X, or the absence of the Y chromosome with two X's. There certainly are very rare accidents in nature where the Y chromosome can be missing, or you can be, it can be duplicated or triplicated.
Sure.
And those, you know, those are situations where the gender is still, the biologic sex is still determined by the presence of the gonads in the case of the male. But it's clearly the presence of the Y chromosome and the signal from there that causes the brain to develop in the baby, to signal to the gonads to produce hormones or respond to hormones from the placenta initially. And it's the gonad is formed. There, you are born either a male or you're born as a female. Again, very rare circumstances where you'll actually potentially have both gonads, an ovary and a testis in the same child. That's a very, very uncommon, very exceedingly rare circumstance.
And
so I would say that that website is using a sort of a pseudoscience, if you will, to,
yes,
to promote the fluidity of the human being that early on. Now, we do know that the external genitalia and the internal genitalia are affected by the hormones produced by the gonads in the male, so that it's an active process to what we call virilize the external genitalia and to regress what are called the Mullerian structures, which are the uterus and the fallopian tubes in the upper portion of the vagina. Those are regressed in with the signal from the gonad. So those things happen in the first 12 weeks of life, such that the genitalia of the male are virilized and essentially completed, except for final sizing, if you will,
now,
in the first 12 weeks of the pregnancy.
As we're discussing these issues, I often think in terms of design and the fact that there is a creator who designed us. At the American College of Pediatricians, is that worldview welcomed and affirmed? I know that many medical societies would resist a clear statement, a simple statement that there is a God who made us, even though there's an enormous percentage of American MDs, medical doctors. A major survey of medical doctors showed that hundreds of thousands of them believe that God had to be involved in the origin of human life. And we've cited the details about that survey on this program. They're on our website. How about at American College of Pediatricians? As we're doing this interview, is it comfortable there for people to affirm that this all looks like design and it shows the hand of the creator?
Well, the philosophy that the college espouses is not a particular religious faith, but it is based on natural law and science. So if you go back to natural law, there is a lawgiver, and so it sort of follows naturally that the design of the human was not purely accidental, but follows, as all science does, chemistry and physics and the kinds of things that allow us to get human beings up into space accurately and back home again. That same natural law on that side of the fence is what makes the most sense and can be proven, if you will. So the lawgiver, and you can call the lawgiver God, as I personally do, but it's in the college, we are strictly a secular organization in that we do not have an affiliation or a specific faith that we expect everyone to have. I believe we all tend to be rather faith-filled people in the organization by nature.
Well, thank you for that explanation. So your article, Gender Ideology Harms Children, there's intense pressure by the culture to suggest that a boy could decide that he's a girl or a girl become a boy. And we've seen that in the headlines, and we've seen many children harmed by that ideology. Your article begins by making a statement about human sexuality, that it's an objective biological binary trait. So could you explain that?
Sure. I think we alluded to it a little bit when we were talking about the developing fetus, and when I responded to the question about gender being fluid in the first 6 or 7 weeks of fetal development. Binary is that, you know, that you are either biologically a male or biologically a female by design, with a very few rare exceptions, and that the concept of gender is really a social construct. It's a sense of what your environment signals to you as you are being, you're identifying yourself as an infant and toddler, and how you respond to your parents and what they, how they respond to you and how the world responds to you and how you view yourself. So it, the gender is essentially a social term. It's not the fluidity, if you will, comes from the social construct and what people imprint on the child postnatally. So if the child is confused about their gender, if you will, they are still biologically the sex they were born. They're either a male or they're a female.
And you mentioned earlier the Y chromosome, the male chromosome, and when these chromosomes were first being identified, it's interesting that for quite a few years, they had the wrong number of chromosomes. They didn't have 46. I forget the number. I think it was 48, which was corrected maybe 10, 15 years later by some research students. But when they first began to look at these chromosomes, they saw shapes, and one chromosome looked like an X, another looked like a Y, and it was eventually determined that all men would have an XY and women have an XX. She's only going to get an X from her mother. She'll be a female. If the child gets a Y from the father and the X from the mother, then that's a male. And so that article that said that the embryo is neither male nor female in the first weeks, that's false. But from the very first moment of fertilization, conception, then it's male or female.
That's correct.
So how about today, nowadays, the statement that homosexuals are born that way, that homosexuality is nature, but gender is nurture, that seems absurd in the highest degree. Because, in fact, sexuality is biological. And then, of course, gender, as you said, there certainly are some boys who will behave like girls and some girls who will behave like boys. That's a secondary issue from whether someone is a male or a female.
That's correct. The whole concept of gender fluidity was sort of an outcome of the researchers, so-called, Kinsey and John Money and Harry Benjamin, who sort of flourished, if you will, in the 60s and 70s with sort of a new, quote, enlightened, unquote, sexual revolution. And it sort of allowed people to theorize, not based on any science, but just based on, you know, ideas in their heads that you could essentially bend a person to whatever gender that society wanted them to be, that they were very fluid and that you, this was a plastic concept. Now, in truth, if you think of gender versus natal sex, you certainly could put pressure, social pressure on a child to assume a different gender, but the biologic sex would remain intact. And there were actually cases in the medical history where we were dealing with the very rare cases of biological intersex where you had both gonads, an ovary and a testis in the same patient, and had ambiguous structures, genital structures, that made it impossible to physically identify the newborn baby as either a male or a female without getting blood testing done to look at their chromosome analysis. Those babies were sort of in limbo, if you will, and decisions were made at the time in, to try to go ahead and determine what would be the best gender of rearing for that child based on what anatomy could do for that child and what the physiology of that child would best be suited. And that is where John Money, this clinical psychologist at Johns Hopkins, sort of put his roots in. And it was a necessary intellectual conversation back in that day. But he took it off beyond that and began working with transgender patients. And Harry Benjamin did the same in this country. And the two of them were absolutely sold on the idea that you could basically grow up and then have sex change operation as an adult and live the life of a different gender or a different sex. And the experiment in that way really failed miserably in the 70s, as Hopkins did. Hopkins was essentially the national resource for transgender surgeries and the procedures that were developed for that. Paul McHugh came into Johns Hopkins in the early 80s, and he assumed the chairmanship of the psychiatry department and reviewed the cases and was utterly dismayed at what had happened and the lack of science behind John Money's suppositions. And he closed the program down. and all the records are still available for review, but there's a lot of sadness and misery in those case reports that when you have a chance to review them. And he basically quieted down what had been the beginning of a trend in the United States to accept transgenderism. And it lay quiet until probably the early 90s. In 2009, the Endocrine Society here in the United States, under the pressure of a committee to establish guidelines for treating transgender patients, began to open up the concept again. And between 2009, when the Endocrine Society published its guidelines for transgender medicine, we have now flourished up to upwards of 40-plus transgender medical centers in the United States, all of them offering treatments for children in the kindergarten age and up, to evaluate them and nourish them and sort of change their gender, if you will. And it's just been accepted rather blindly with no science behind it. And this is what the college is really upset about, is that when you review the science, you see the folly of all of this. And we are starting all over again with what John Money did back in the 70s, and now we're doing it on steroids, essentially, with technologies that allow blocking pubertal development purposely and then reintroducing opposite-sex hormones later on to create a population of transgendered adults who will be sort of an experimental group to see kind of how these people grow up with their lives and whether or not it works for them or not. And this is just it's a sad human experiment that we feel is essentially harmful to the child. If an adult wants to make a decisions about that, that's great. But to go ahead and take a child below the age of consent, stop their puberty, and introduce cross-sex hormones, we feel is absolutely and utterly abusive.
Well, here in Colorado, Real Science Radio's, we're in the Denver metropolitan area, and of course Trinidad, Colorado, was long called the sex change capital of the world. And so this destructive ideology seems to go hand in hand with other perversions of biological and sexual health. You mentioned Alfred Kinsey. We've interviewed a Dr. Judith Reisman, and she has written about the children of Table 34. It's research based on children abused by pedophiles. And he obviously had interviews with, and there's one child that's grown up who says that Kinsey paid his father to rape him to get the data that he wanted for his research. So the early seeds of this kind of thinking, it was all destructive from the beginning. And now, fast forward some decades, there's quite a bit of data on children who've been treated this way and who've been abused, little boys, to be raised as girls and vice versa. Could you talk to us about that?
Well, I don't have a lot of personal data in front of me. The person that I knew and trusted in terms of the quality of his work and the passion for excellence and good science was Kenneth Zucker, who was in Toronto, and he maintained the center for transgender patients there in Toronto up until this past year, when he was relieved of his position and his clinic was shut down by the Children's Hospital there because he wasn't being politically correct or sensitive enough. He actually worked diligently to delve into the pathology of the family that surrounds the transgender patient to look at where the signaling was coming that would give this child the sense that they were signaled as seeing themselves as a different gender. And he would work with those families to undo that pathology, if at all possible, and return the child to their natal gender identity. Mm. And in the few cases that just didn't work out, he carried these patients through their late adolescence and then let those patients make a decision on their own about what they intended to do as adults. Mm. So he worked very, very hard and had hundreds of families that he cared for and brought through this process. He's the only one that I'm aware of who actually worked to look at the pathology of the transgender child and try to build it back into, you know, something medically sound and for the mental disorder that transgenderism is. He fought tooth and nail with the American Psychological Association to to keep them from removing gender identity disorder as a disorder. But his battle was lost, and the committee that makes those decisions at the APA decided and voted to go ahead and change gender identity disorder into gender dysphoria, which is basically saying that the gender identity crisis is not a disease state at all. It's a variation of normal, and that the dysphoria is the misery that the patient experiences as society treats them poorly. So we are basically building an artificial bubble around all of these transgendered children as they grow up, keeping them from going through puberty, which puberty, as we know historically, is what restores their gender identity to their natal gender. If nothing else, going through puberty does the job in upwards of 98% of boys and 85% of women. And some studies show a little less of a resolution, but clearly the vast majority of patients in every single valid clinical study return to their natal gender once they go through puberty. And we are taking that transforming experience and treating it as if it's a pathologic state, stopping that puberty in order for them to not return to their natal gender, and then cuddling them along with hormones and making them in a bubble world where laws will protect them from having to go to the bathroom in the wrong place or feel put upon by society because society doesn't accept them in their transgendered environment. So it's a hideous experiment, and it's widely accepted in academic circles. There is no dialogue whatsoever with our side on the issue. This statement we made, we felt needed to be made, and we're getting an incredible amount of positive feedback from medical practitioners across the United States.
Wow.
Indicating that they feel strongly that we have made a statement that is true.
Well, you guys point out that puberty is not a disease, and when you give children hormones, puberty blocking hormones, inherently that can be dangerous.
The danger is, there's twofold. The danger is if you block puberty when puberty is a curative event for the transgender child, it's dangerous. Number two, when you block puberty at a time when puberty is actually supposed to happen, you are undoing a number of things, including maturation of organ systems, maturation of the brain, accretion of calcium into the skeleton, which is very important for skeletal health for the remainder of your life. You're basically subtracting that out at a time when it's very important that it should happen naturally. We use the puberty-blocking hormones for very valid reasons in children who start puberty at extremely early ages due to pathology or just for reasons that we don't understand. So when we have a 5-year-old girl who develops breasts and pubic hair and begins menstruating at age 6 or 7, the puberty-blocking hormones are designed specifically to stop that process temporarily and allow that child to grow through their young childhood without being thrown into puberty prematurely. But once the age of puberty hits, that child is taken off those medications and puberty is allowed then to proceed forward. And there's plenty of safety data to say that's an okay thing to do, that it brings very little harm to the child if it's done that way. But we are talking about stopping kids who are pubertal from experiencing puberty at all. And that's where the danger lies.
The statistics you gave earlier, if I'm reading your article correctly, they come in part from the American Psychiatric Association, a report in 2013 on the percentage of boys and girls who reach puberty. And those males who were raised as females, 98% of gender-confused boys will, as they pass through puberty, accept their biological sex, and 88% of gender-confused girls will accept their biological sex. So that in and of itself, of course, is significant, but it's the kind of statistic that we don't hear from the science and health mainstream media outlets.
I had an opportunity to present this side of the issue of transgenderism at our Southeast Regional Pediatric Endocrine Society meeting in Atlanta in November. And as I was preparing to give the talk and speaking with my fellow pediatric endocrinologists, not a single one of them was aware of these statistics. Mm-hmm. They had never heard them. they said, well, that can't be true. If that's true, why would we even consider doing transgender treatments with puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones? I mean, why would we do that if these numbers are true? They obviously can't be true. And I just looked at my colleagues and said, it's absolutely, utterly true. As a matter of fact, the DMS-5 criteria report specifically quotes those studies. And actually, the articles that are written in the lay journals, well, they're not lay, we call them the throwaway journals, for pediatricians to read, the transgender child, there's a disclaimer right up in front of the first or second paragraph of the article about transgenderism that says it resolves in most cases anyway. Mm. And then that is just sort of forgotten almost instantly, and the philosophy of intervention and treatment is carried on from that point on in these articles. And
well,
it's almost like the emperor's new clothes. You really just, it makes you drop your jaw to think that people would be that blind to something that is so phenomenally powerful statistically.
And then the rates of suicide that you guys point out among adults who use cross-sex hormones or undergo sex reassignment surgery are 20 times greater than the rest of the population. And this is true even in Sweden. So when they say, well, that's because the culture condemns them, well, actually, the culture celebrates homosexuality. It condemns me. I'm a conservative fundamentalist Christian. I'm condemned by the culture. I'm, you know, called every derogatory term. That's fine. But the culture, certainly in the Western world, celebrates homosexuality today. But even in Sweden, you find these horrifically high rates of suicide.
The sad thing about the studies that were published, which show those statistics to be true, is that the authors who wrote them were pressured to retract their statements after they had published the articles by the gay and transgender community. The immense amount of pressure placed on the academicians who discover facts that are unfortunately really the fly in the face of this whole transgender movement. Mm. They are literally castigated by their colleagues to the point of stopping publishing and making, you know, retractions of their articles try to happen. And Kenneth Zucker, as I mentioned, the researcher from Toronto, refused to back down, and he was essentially just relieved of his position overnight. And that is how strong and vile the lobby is on the other side of the issue.
Yeah.
They take no prisoners. They want it all.
We see that with abortion. We see that with intelligent design. We see that in many areas where those who claim the mantle of tolerance, free speech, and diversity are anything but. You guys end your article with the statement that conditioning children into believing a lifetime of chemical and surgical impersonation of the opposite sex is normal, and that it's healthful, that is child abuse. That's child abuse. And then your name and two other doctors with the American College of Pediatricians, you guys have signed this article. We're so very thankful that you've done this. I'm thrilled to hear that you're getting positive comments from people in the medical field.
Well, it's very heartening to get positive feedback from a number of angles. And of course, there is the vilification that happens, which is almost patent and almost identical in every way, referring to us as an organization of no consequence that uses a name and represents no one and has no science and whatnot. It's pretty much all stated the same way. So it comes from the same sort of source as trying to work against us and to bury our opinion. But we're
right.
We stand by what is best for children. As I said, we are not a specifically faith-based organization. However, I believe everyone that's part of the American College of Pediatricians has a personal faith of their own that drives their moral fiber in a direction that literally, you know, scours the research to make sure that what we recommend is first and foremost always best for the child and not satisfying the needs of the adults as the primary motivating force.
And those criticisms, we're almost out of time, but those criticisms, they're basically ad hominem and poisoning the well, so that often they'd prefer the opposition just to avoid the science, to avoid the data, and to avoid the consequences that these children go through. In fact, in your article, you guys point out that if a person believes that he or she is something that they are not, that at best, that's a sign of confused thinking. So we would point out, even to the adult male, do not pretend that you're a woman. Don't behave like a woman. To the adult female, don't pretend that you're a man. You don't have to be a man to be valuable, to be healthy. A man is a man, and a woman is a woman.
I would like to sort of close with a wonderful quote from Paul McHugh, and this is not an exact quote, but he states it so eloquently. He said, "Treating a transgendered patient with hormones and surgery is like offering an anorexic patient liposuction and a diet as treatment for their delusion."
Wow.
And that is, to me, such a powerful statement, because no one in their right mind would think about doing liposuction and diet for a disordered anorexic patient who has the worldview that they are morbidly obese when they are actually starving themselves to death. And yet, this is the same kind of delusion with transgenderism. Uh-huh. And why we would ever consider contributing to the madness by treating the madness instead of trying to treat the patient and their disorder and bring them some kind of relief from their suffering with counseling and other ways other than buying into their delusion. It's beyond the pale.
Wow. Very powerful quote. Thank you so very much, Dr. Quentin Van Meter. What an honor to have you on Real Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Until next week, or until the Lord returns, this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, our website, rsr.org. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.